Welcome to episode 24 of the Language Neuroscience Podcast. I'm Stephen Wilson. Thanks for listening. My guest today is Leena Pilkkinen, Professor of Linguistics and Psychology at NYU. Leena investigates the neural basis of semantic and syntactic combinatorial processing using magnetoencephalography, or MEG. Much of her work is characterized by elegant, carefully constructed experimental designs that are informed by linguistic theory, and she really takes advantage of the temporal and spatial resolution of MEG to study neural responses to specific linguistic operations. As an example of this kind of work, we're going to talk about her recent paper, Disentangling Semantic Composition and Semantic Association in the Left Temporal Lobe, with first author Zhijing Li, Journal of Neuroscience 2021. Okay, let's get to it.
Hi, Leena. How are you?
Hi, Stephen. I'm pretty good. How are you?
Yeah, good. It's a lovely day in Nashville. How about you? Where are you at?
I'm in Lower Manhattan at home, and it is basically a summer day here too, which is not usual for early November, but yeah,
yeah,
that's where we are.
I'm really hoping that this warm spell will just last a little bit longer. I want to like kind of fit in one more camping trip before the winter is upon us.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be a very nice weekend here.
Yeah, so we've been trying to set this up for a long time. I think there was like multiple bouts of COVID and then summer plans and all kinds of stuff, right?
Yes. Yeah, it's been in the works for a while, but finally we made it. And nobody has COVID as far as we can tell.
So I know that you've listened to the podcast before, so you know that I like to get started by asking people about their interests when they were a kid and how they found their way into this niche of science that we all find ourselves in. So can you tell me about that for you? Like, what were you interested in when you were a kid?
Yeah, so I definitely knew that I wanted to somehow make language my job very, very early on. So it kind of clicked for me actually when I first started studying English in school. So in the Finnish system back then, it was at the start of third grade. So I was 8 years old then.
And were you speaking only Finnish up to that point?
That's right. I was only speaking Finnish up to that point.
Uh-huh.
And I remember how I just immediately kind of loved the feeling of a foreign language in my mouth, sort of. And I also remember that as we started learning vocabulary, like we would just point to objects in the room and start learning the words for those objects, I felt that I needed to decide whether I should have an American accent, which is what I mostly heard on TV, or the British accent that my teacher had. And no other student was like wrestling with this question, but I felt like, well, now I need to like pick the phonology. And since I mostly heard American English on TV, I went with that. And the teacher was kind of puzzled. It's like, well, how do I all of a sudden have a little American girl in class? But then that was already sort of an early interest in just kind of learning a foreign language. So that's sort of what it was like up until I got to university. So I just really enjoyed, you know, learning foreign languages. And I did the kind of usual European menu. So I had four foreign languages in school. There was nothing exceptional about that. Then what exactly you do with that interest is a little unclear. So I definitely wanted language to be the job, but how to do that, you don't know, right? Mm-hmm. So the very canonical choice in many European universities is to then major in some type of philology in university. So then I admitted into the English philology major after I graduated high school. And there it's a combination of literature and then you do a little bit of linguistics. And I immediately knew that I really had no particular interest in doing literature. And as soon as I encountered linguistics, I immediately knew that that is really what I was looking for.
That was it.
Yeah. And then, you know, I had kind of wanted to do an exchange here in the US already as a high school student, but that would have been extremely expensive. But then when you are in university, they have exchange programs with US universities. And so then as soon as I was able to do that, apply for one of those fellowships, I did. And then I got one and I ended up in the University of Pittsburgh, where there was a really good linguistics department at the time. And I was able to sort of get started.
Okay. What was Pittsburgh like as your sort of introduction to the English speaking world?
I really enjoyed it. So it was a bigger city than the city that I was coming from in Finland, which was Tampere, which is the second largest city in Finland, but it's still not a large city. So Pittsburgh was a more exciting place. And I had this kind of desire to be in the US for a long time. And so then I really felt like I had arrived, and I felt, you know, very comfortable right away, and, you know, just had a really great time. And the department was a really, really nice environment. And so I was an undergraduate exchange student at that point. But I was able to do a lot of the master's classes already during that exchange year. And then through a kind of a complicated path, I was able to get admitted to the master's program, even though I did not have an undergraduate degree yet. And so then I did an MA there. In linguistics before I went to do my PhD at MIT.
Did you ever finish your undergrad degree?
I didn't finish any type of undergraduate degree. So like, if you look at my CV, it kind of looks like I'm a college dropout. But also at the time in the Finnish university system, there really wasn't anything like the US undergraduate degree, which was also common in other European systems. So you master's really was the first degree that you were going to do anyway.
Right. And did the Americans accept your American accent? Did they find it authentic?
Yes. I actually have a funny story. The very first day that I had arrived at Pitt, University of Pittsburgh, I was in the elevator in the Cathedral of Learning. So there's the main building on campus is a very tall building. I forget how many floors now, but very many. And linguistics was like up there. And I was in the elevator and I was chatting with somebody, and somehow it came up that I was an exchange student. And then that person said like, "Oh, you really don't have an accent. Like, how long have you been here?" And I was like, "Well, I came yesterday." And he was like, "That's crazy." I'm like, "Well, but I've sounded like this more or less since I was 8. I've started obsessing about pronunciation."
That's funny.
So, yeah.
Okay, so you went to MIT, like the epicenter of linguistics, or at least of one kind of linguistics, I guess I should say. And how was that? Did you have a good time there?
I really did have an amazing time at MIT. It was a very marked choice for me for graduate school because the Pitt Linguistics Department wasn't, or at least my advisor there, who was Rich Thomason, kind of one of the Montagovian semanticists, was not a super generative Chomsky in place. And so I actually thought, and the kind of research that I was doing really wasn't. So I was using a formalism that I kind of stitched together from, you know, LFG and HBSG, which are not, you know, the, you know, sort of Chomsky in theory. So I really thought I was going to go to like Stanford or Ohio State or one of those universities. But then when I visited MIT, it was the place where I felt like I kind of least understood the way they were thinking. But it was clearly the kind of dominant paradigm. And I, at that point, like amazingly for my whatever 23-year-old brain, I had kind of an insight. I was like, if I don't come here, if I don't study with these guys, I'll never really understand this. And then I also really loved the student body. Like they, you know, they were really amazing. And so I chose MIT, and I really, I mean, those years I would still say are, you know, one of the best in my life. So it really was a special time. And I, you know, really, really did enjoy it.
Yeah. But you didn't really grow into like a hardcore generativist, did you?
I mean, I'm an empiricist. I did a fully theoretical dissertation. I was always interested in the syntax semantics interface. And I came into the program with a pretty good training in kind of event-based semantics. And then at MIT, I encountered a more formal way to do compositional semantics. And then I sort of married the theory that I had learned really during my master's at Pitt with the sort of more Hyman-Kreutzer type lambda calculus of compositional semantics, and then kind of worked with that system. And Angelika Kratzer was, you know, had also been developing that combination. And so I worked, you know, within a lot of the typical assumptions, I would say, yeah.
So your dissertation is not a cognitive neuroscience dissertation, huh? Not know that.
No. My dissertation is called Introducing Arguments, and it gives a theory about kind of the verbal domain, specifically how arguments of verbs, other than, say, the subject and the object, or kind of the core arguments, get introduced into the meaning. So, for example, I worked a lot with indirect objects, also cross-linguistically in some African languages, and causative constructions, like Bill broke the glass type. And so that's still my most cited work, Stephen. So.
Oh, I didn't even know that. I used to be very interested in argument structure too when I was like a student. I was trained by people that were very into argument structure. So yeah, I'm sure we could probably talk about that for a whole hour if you wanted to, but I don't know that everybody would appreciate that. You started doing MEG or magnetoencephalography, which seems compulsory because you're Finnish, right? And MEG is like the domain of Finns. Now, is there like a national rule that that's like the methodology that you have to use when you're Finnish?
No, that it is the running joke that I am the control case. So even if you get displaced from Finland, you still end up doing MEG because it's just like programmed in. But no, it is interesting. So I am Finnish and I do MEG, but I really did not train with the, you know, Finnish pioneers. I really discovered MEG at MIT, and it took me a while before I learned that the Finns do it too.
So I was kind of joking. That is really funny. But why is like Finland so strong in MEG research? Were they critical sort of pioneers of the technology over there?
Yeah. So I think they were critical pioneers of the technology. And then, you know, there's just certain pioneering researchers who, really started showing the utility of the technique for, you know, kind of more cognitive questions like Riitta Hari. And then in the more, analysis technique side, Matti Hämäläinen. And so, and there's, you know, this a couple of really thriving groups that do magnetoencephalography. So
So can you tell me about how you when you first encountered that methodology? Was it very exciting to realize that you were going to be able to address your questions and in the brain?
So that's not at all how it started. So I came to MIT with this really interest in formal semantics because that is what I had, you know, had always been interested in. As the first summer came, so after the first year in the program, I needed a summer job. There really wasn't summer funding, so I needed to do something, and I didn't want to go back to Finland and, you know, do something totally unrelated. And at that point, Alec Morantz had acquired an MEG machine that, you know, he controlled. And it was pretty new, but since I was really new too, I didn't really understand how new it was. He was also like trying to sort of still very much learn about it. And he was looking for kind of a lab manager RA just for the summer. And I had no interest in experimental research at all. It sort of had like an unappealingly practical flavor for me because I sort of thought about myself as very theoretical and more, you know, leaning towards philosophy than anything as practical as psycholinguistics or neurolinguistics. But I really needed a job. So then I was like, okay, I can try to like push these buttons. And so then I came into that position knowing nothing and just gradually kind of started to learn. And then something actually kind of clicked. So the next year I did then, you know, take neurolinguistics and I started getting into it more intellectually. And as I think about it backwards, I think what really appealed to me is the notion that you can have a result. So when you're doing theoretical research, you never know when a project is finished. Like there just is no definition of when you are finished with a project. But when you're doing experiments, there is a way to find a project and there is kind of a way to know when you're done. And that suits my personality way better than this feeling that you're never done. And so I think, you know, like I did, you know, I was very intrigued by the brain. Like it feels like kind of an astronaut. You're going to unknown places. You know, if you do a manipulation that, you know, nobody has ever done, it's incredibly exciting to see how that affects the brain. Cause like nobody has seen that before. It's like traveling to a new city every time. But that was important, but the notion of like being able to complete a project and kind of organize your life more in that way was definitely something that appealed to me.
Huh. And so that was when it sort of, your research started to go more and more in that direction.
Yeah.
And
so then in graduate school, I then had these two lives. So I was doing the theoretical work very seriously. But then I also started to work on just basic lexical access, not because I was interested in lexical access, but because at that point, it really felt that we kind of knew almost nothing. So I'm talking like 98, 99 now. So a while ago. You couldn't ask questions about applicative and causative constructions or any of the types of questions that I really was interested in theoretically. And it seemed like if you wanted to kind of carve out to the brain space, you had to have some clue of what just like basic lexical access would look like in the brain in order to start getting into the more structural aspects of it. So obviously like you could be more interested at lower levels, like, you know, phonological categorization or something like that. But I was always a meaning person, not a sound person. So it seemed like the, you know, like lexical access was sort of the starting point on those types of questions.
And obviously you've kind of brought them together over the years, right? I mean, you've made your research program more and more about combinatorial semantics.
Yeah, so it took a while. But then when I, started as a postdoc at NYU, that is when I was, when I was kind of for the first time able to connect with my kind of theoretical expertise. So I had kind of a floating postdoc across labs. NYU was kind of working on a faculty position for me, and they first were able to bring me in as a postdoc. So I was working with Brian Macquarie, who had done a lot of behavioral work on so-called coercion constructions. So expressions like "the author began the book," where "begin" and "book" don't really easily go together semantically upon first sight, because "begin" is kind of an aspectual verb and it's really looking for something like an event predicate to combine with, like "begin singing" or something like that. But when we get something like "begin the book," there's actually a decent amount of behavioral evidence that something extra happens there. There's like a processing delay, and we think it's associated with some kind of an you're invoking that implicit activity. So you are in fact interpreting that expression as "the author began some activity involving the book." Uh-huh. So we, you know, then did a first MEG experiment on those kinds of expressions. And then I did, a bunch of work on different types of expressions of that flavor. And that was kind of like the first body of work that was really then kind of on representational questions that I really was also theoretically interested in. So yeah, I would say then at the postdoc level, it was sort of a little more unified, but I was not able to continue my theoretical work. I really wasn't able to like do like cognitive neuroscience of language seriously. And then also theoretical.
No,
serious. Like,
I mean, this is a full-time job, you know,
it's totally a full-time job.
I mean, unless you're like, you know,
something would have to get. Yeah.
So how would you, I mean, like for somebody that doesn't know your, you know, what your lab's all about, like how would you sum up like the sort of central questions of your lab these days?
Well, I think I've had the same central question for a really long time, and it's a really hard one. So I may always have it, because I doubt that we're really completely going to crack it mechanistically, but it really is the question: how do our brains construct complex meanings? Of course, that is in some sense the question that everyone is asking. But I think you know, so, you know, ultimately the answer will be a description of, you know, like the full machine that's in the brain that accomplishes in it and that accomplishes this. And hopefully we'll have, you know, a very mechanistic understanding of it. I think what we have been able to do is, you know, shed some detail into the picture. So obviously, a big focus of our studies for the last many years has been the function of the left anterior temporal cortex, which has been kind of the most consistent correlate of composition in our hands. And since we're studying it with magnetoencephalography, we're able to kind of lock the analysis into a certain time frame. So we're able to study a certain stage of processing as opposed to just a spatial location. And I think that's very important because that has allowed us to have at least, you know, some level of consistency in the responses across studies. So we know that we're always like looking at this relatively early response around 200 to 250 milliseconds after the onset of usually a visual word that's in a combinatory context. Uh-huh. The basic finding is that there's an elevation in amplitude, you know, if the word is in a combinatory context. And it does not seem to, although this is was our first guess that it might reflect something like syntactic composition, I think we've pretty compellingly ruled out that hypothesis. And it does seem to have a more conceptual flavor. So it is some variant of conceptual combination. And we've done a pretty systematic body of work, kind of really trying to understand what are the possible inputs to that, that operation and what are not possible inputs to that operation. So, you know, it has sort of a level of detail that I find satisfying in the sense that we're not, it's not just like, oh, even not just this is conceptual combination, but we're able to say something about it in a little bit more detail. So it goes back to that kind of theoretical work where you're trying to actually explain, you know, why a sentence means what it means. So, you know, theoretical semantics or formal semantics, we write the lexical entries of each of the words, and there's a formalism that puts those lexical entries together. And then there's a sentence meaning that is compositionally derived from the pieces. And so like at the end of the day, we'd love to do something like that, as a neural description. And we're very far from that, obviously very far. But, you know, it's like when we start to understand the details, that's what I find interesting and sort of fun. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that your lab has like one of the most cohesive focused research programs of any lab in our field, you know, like, it's like, you know, you definitely have a central question and everything that you do is revolves around that. And I think you take this very sort of bottom-up approach too, which I think is interesting. And what I wanted to do is talk about one of the recent papers that we had mentioned, and that kind of give our listeners like an example of this work. Mm-hmm. The one I thought would be a good fit is called Disentangling Semantic Composition and Semantic Association in the Left Temporal Lobe, by Lee and Pilkkonen. So can we like kind of delve into that one a bit? And maybe first, could you tell me a bit first about your co-author on this paper?
Yeah, so Zhijing Li was a postdoc in our Abu Dhabi branch of the lab. She did her PhD with John Hale, who was at the time was still at Cornell. And now actually she just started a faculty position in Hong Kong. So she's just a first semester assistant professor.
Yeah, so it's a very nice paper that she's first author of in the Journal of Neuroscience. And before we like kind of get into the details of it, you know, you talked about MEG. I guess you call it MEG. I don't know. I call it MEG. Is that acceptable? Or is that like a faux pas?
I think you have to say MEG. I actually don't find MEG very acceptable. But
really? Okay, fine. I'll try. Okay, I'll try. MEG.
Say MEG, yeah.
People do say it?
They do say it. It's fine. It's fine.
You don't like it? Okay, well, I'll see what I can do. So you mentioned the kind of the ability to ask temporal questions. So can you kind of talk for people that are not familiar with the methodology, can you talk about the spatial and temporal resolution of it and kind of how it works and the advantages in that respect?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so MEG reflects the magnetic fields that are associated with our neurons' electrical activity. And so it has millisecond temporal resolution. So as quick as you want to go, we can go with MEG. So it's parallel to EEG in that sense. But then unlike EEG, which kind of gets, you know, the potentials get distorted as you go from the neuronal source. By the time you're at the scalp, there's sort of a, you know, it's not a pretty reflection of what was the underlying configuration. So the relationship between the magnetic fields that we capture outside the head and the configuration of the sources in the brain is just much more transparent for MEG than it is for EEG. So we're able to create a model of the sources. And so it is important to keep in mind that we're not imaging the brain. It's not an image of the neuronal activity. It is a model of it. And, you know, as with any kind of modeling, like it'll change if you do it with a different pipeline or something like that. So it's rougher, but the spatial resolution is in the order of kind of centimeters, depending where you are inside the head. Deeper sources are less accurate than more superficial sources. That's one of the differences. But it's, you know, as for how non-invasive methods go, it is the best combination of time and space that we have non-invasively. And so if you want to have a measurement of the whole head with really great temporal resolution and pretty good spatial resolution, MEG is the way to get it with what we have available.
Yeah, it's the advantages are clear, and not many people, there's not that many universities that have it, right? I mean, it's nowhere near as common as functional MRI or EEG.
Yeah, it hasn't taken off clinically the way that, you know, MRI has, and so that's,
I think it's just a lot more expensive, right? And well, you don't think so? Then I guess a scanner has many functions, whereas an MRI scanner has many functions, whereas an MEG.
It's not actually more expensive, but I don't want to speculate about all the reasons why this situation might hold.
Okay, and you mentioned like it's kind of geared towards more like superficial sources are going to be easier to track than deep because of, you know, you're measuring with on the scalp, obviously.
To an extent, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then like sulci versus gyri, does it kind of have like anatomical biases there?
A little bit, yeah. So it really loves the sulci because the current is kind of oriented in the right way for the MEG sensors to capture the magnetic flux in a really nice way. MEG may have a little bit of a blind spot at the very top of the gyrus, but then as soon as there's a little bit of curvature, the the fields start to be picked up again. But you know, like when people have really kind of rigorously measured exactly how much signal might be lost, it's like so little that it probably doesn't really make much of a practical difference.
Okay, well, all of the important language regions are in the superior temporal sulcus anyway, so that's fine. Okay, and so you're using MEG, and you're trying to dissociate what you call semantic association and semantic composition. Can you explain those two concepts?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I was interested in this contrast for quite a long time, mostly because, so half of my appointment is in psychology and half of my appointment is in linguistics. So it's like a fully joint 50-50 appointment. And so, you know, I especially in my, early assistant professor years, I interacted with my memory colleagues and kind of through that, I learned that there are studies in the memory literature that oftentimes look a lot like our studies, but what they called those studies was studies on associative encoding. So just kind of building associations between words as opposed to actually combining them semantically or conceptually. And oftentimes when they would look at our studies, they'd be like, well, that's kind of like just association. But of course, you know, as linguists and language scientists, we do not think about composition as association. They're very different things. Example that I often use is that, you know, like you're at the breakfast table, you can have a coffee and a cake there, you know, so those representations are very strongly associated in your mind, right? But that's very different from a coffee cake.
Right.
So two representations can just be associated, but that's different from actually combining them together into, you know, a conceptual combination, and also in this case, a compound or a linguistic phrase.
Yep.
Interesting thing is, and so this was really what got me interested in this question, is that, you know, so we very consistently see effects of composition in the left anterior temporal lobe. And we've been able to show that really is more of a conceptual process than a process where you're taking like syntactic categories and building a phrase. Uh-huh. But the surprising thing is, or maybe not surprising, depending where you're coming from, is that associative encoding also drives the left ATL, including in the monkey brain.
Uh-huh.
So it's very interesting to think about that contrast and the, you know, possible connection. So, you know, I think it's imaginable that our kind of combinatory ability might stem from some more elementary associative encoding. Like there could be a real relationship there. And the kind of spatial proximity was very intriguing. So I had been interested in really like kind of looking into that contrast in a controlled fashion for a while. And, you know, I oftentimes when I teach my graduate, like advanced seminars for PhD students in neurolinguistics, I sort of float experimental ideas just to see if anyone bites or wants to pursue them. And so I had liked this idea of playing with the associations between countries and foods. Because uh-huh. That's clearly something that, you know, it's kind of easy to vary. And then the kind of cute thing in English is that you can usually turn a country name into an adjective with a relatively small morphological chain. So like Italy, Italian, you know, Korea, Korean. So you could create pairs that are just either associated or not, like Korean kimchi, Korean tacos, and you can vary the phrasal structure. So you can just have Korea kimchi or Korean kimchi. So it's a pretty minimal change. Uh-huh. And so then with Zhijing, who already had done some work on kind of composition versus association. So she had some prior fMRI results showing some sensitivity in the left ATL to just level of semantic association in a naturalistic text. And so then, you know, our interests kind of converge. And so then we did this more controlled study. So it's like a very basic crossing of composition where we're varying whether the first element is a noun or an adjective. So the noun doesn't really go with the subsequent noun as a phrase, whereas the adjective does. And then the level of association. So you would have Korean kimchi, Italian kimchi, Korea kimchi, Italy kimchi. And then you just get a picture afterwards that you have to match to it. And we wanted to see whether the association and composition would have sort of a similar effect in the left ATL.
Okay, so I'm just going to restate the design of the study just because it's so important. Using the examples that you have in the paper, so it's all about France and Korea and cheese in this case in the figure in the paper. So you got this 2x2 design. Things can either be composed, so it would be like in that would be French cheese or Korean cheese, or they could be not composed or just lists, which would be France cheese or Korea cheese. And then you're also varying the extent of association. So French cheese is much more associated than Korean cheese. And that should apply to the list version as well, right? So that's the 2x2 crossover design.
Yeah, very simple.
Yeah, it is, but it's like elegant. So then you present these to your participants and record their brands with MEG or MEG, as you like it. And I kind of wanted to, like, in terms of the results, I wanted to start with one of the simpler ones that's not really the main point of the paper, but just kind of shows that it's all working, which is the frequency effects that you observed. Can you, I don't know, if do you, it's a couple of years ago, do you remember how it comes out?
I remember there are frequency effects, but yeah, no, this is definitely very pre-pandemic work, so I sort of remember the forest, but maybe not all the trees.
Okay.
But yeah, I assume the frequency effect is like the usual kind, so temporal cortex.
Yeah, you found this middle temporal frequency effect, and it's really nice in the paper because you see the timing of it, right? Like, so you've got these two word combinations, and like, you know, exactly, you know, just after word one is presented, you have this frequency effect for word one, and then just after word two is presented, you have a frequency effect for word two. And it's really neat because, like, you can just kind of see that, like, the brain activity, like, reflects the frequency of the word with less activity for more frequent words, right?
Okay, cool. I should include that when I talk about this study, which I haven't done. But
oh, I don't know. It was just my way of making sense of it, because I wanted to start with... I mean, to me, I wanted to start with a manipulation where I had a hypothesis about what it should look like in the brain. And to me, that's the manipulation that I have prior. And so I like to start with that one because it shows you that, it makes sense. But then that's not really what it's all about, right? So you want to talk about like the main findings regarding that 2x2 design?
Yeah, so this study, obviously, one half of it is kind of like your totally ordinary priming study, right? So we have highly related pairs and lowly related pairs. So France cheese, Korea cheese. So in some sense, that to me is kind of sanity checky. So we have a massive literature that kind of tells you what direction that effect should go. So we should see some sort of a amplitude reduction for the highly related pair, right? France cheese, everyone predicts, like, if you had any kind of response time task, that should be faster. We, you know, in the electrophysiological responses, there should be a lower amplitude. Usually we see it on the N400. But that's kind of a very, you know, there's lots of prior data on that kind of a contrast. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, although so far in this chat, we have been talking about the left ATL just in terms of its sensitivity to composition, it's very well known that it also just responds to single words. So no one's claiming that it's some kind of composition selective region. There's lots of compelling evidence that it definitely represents, you know, just single word representations as well, or does something with them. And so now what's interesting here is that when it comes to the what we call the list stimuli, where we just have the two nouns that they're not forming a phrase, we see exactly that type of effect. It's like an amplitude reduction for the more related items. So that's cheese when it's being preceded by France as opposed to Korea. Okay, great.
Okay, so France cheese has lower signal in the ATL than Korea cheese.
Yeah, but the main result that we report is that that pattern is an interaction. So when you put the phrasal context into it, so now we have French cheese versus Korean cheese, the effect actually flips. So French cheese is actually elicits a lower left ATL amplitude than Korean cheese. So actually, when it comes to those combinatorial representations, the left ATL, you know, activates more for that kind of higher associative pair in the presence of the phrasal structure. So that's kind of, you know, That's very intriguing.
It sure is. So
you manage to get this kind of like anti-priming effect by adding just a very small change, just changing the category of the first element.
Yeah,
so I just think it's really interesting, you know? I mean, mm-hmm. we obviously have to understand it, you know, better by running future studies, but I do think it's very intriguing that, you know, like we did not predict this at all. Like we mainly were interested in eliciting the effect of association and the effect of composition. And we kind of wanted to compare them spatially, even though our technique is not awesome for a spatial resolution, but we still want to see, like, is there some kind of dissociation or do they really affect the same, you know, kind of MEG set of sources? And this interaction was a surprise. I'm like, okay.
Yeah, because that's like the first thing that you report in the results, which sort of, you know, follows classic, like, you know, psychological reporting practices, right? If you've got a 2x2 design, you start with the interaction because you don't want to be like messing around with main effects if there's like an interaction, right? So you start with this interaction and it's rather shocking to see that so why do you think that is? Why would the ATL show an enhanced signal for French cheese over Korean cheese when it's showing the exact opposite if it's, you know, just noun lists?
Mm-hmm. So I don't know. You know, there's a few different ways that you can sort of begin to think about the hypothesis space. I think one possibility could be that it has something to do with the fact that it is a highly associated, I mean, it's basically, there is an existing representation for French cheese, obviously. And there isn't really for Korean cheese. And so then when you're putting together French cheese, you are getting that kind of like activity boost from, you know, presumably some kind of a combinatory process. And maybe what you're adding on top of that is sort of an activation of that existing memory representation as well. And maybe when you just have the list pair, you know, France, cheese, that combined concept is not activated in the same way. That's one, I think, like direction that one could sort of think about. That there, you know, there's sort of an added activation of an existing representation in the phrasal case when you're actually putting together the concept.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. That was how I was sort of thinking about it too as I was reading it. Mm-hmm. You have this, I'm sort of skipping, I guess, like, I'm presenting your paper in a different order than how you wrote it. But, you know, you have this second analysis you do where you use searchlight multivariate pattern analysis. And that kind of has this really interesting finding in the ATL as well, where you find that the left ATL distinguishes very, like, this sort of pattern recognition algorithm can distinguish very well between high association composition, i.e. French cheese, and low association composition, i.e. Korean cheese. But it can't really do any of the other classifications. And I guess that kind of bolsters what you just said. Like, there might be something special about these sort of almost lexicalized combinations. I mean, I guess I haven't seen the rest of your stimuli. I mean, do you think, are all of your stimuli as evocative as French cheese?
I think we have kind of a visualization of the full stimulus set. They're not, you know, they obviously vary to some extent, but we, you know, we do have, you know, Mexican tacos. Cheese. And so one thing that is kind of interesting is that for a lot of these cases, the composition is kind of trivial, you know, like kimchi, well, kimchi's Korean, you know, like the modifier is in some sense always almost like semantically redundant for many of the pairings. And especially in light of what we knew about the left ATL from our prior studies on the effects of conceptual specificity on this activity, where we had shown that if you have a conceptually more specific context item integrating to the current item, you get a larger composition effect than if you have kind of a vaguer item integrating into the current item. So if I have, for example, tomato soup, I'm measuring activity on soup. So the impact of integrating tomato versus vegetable soup, tomato soup will give me a higher effect. Okay. So like it's kind of more, I'm pouring more information into the noun. So now from that perspective, it's very weird that French cheese would give me more activity than Korean cheese, because like Korean cheese is like, whoa, you know, that should be very surprising, very informative, whereas French cheese is much less so. So that I find that contrast very interesting. So I do think a pretty big proportion, I'd have to like look at them more carefully here. But yeah, I think a lot of them were this kind of like Italian pizza, you know, like very strongly associated terms, but not like expressions that we maybe say that much. Cause you know,
you don't go around saying, oh, let's go and try some Korean kimchi tonight.
So, okay.
So you contrast this ATL finding with different patterns in the more posterior temporal regions, like what you call middle temporal. So you have an effective composition in the middle sort of mid MTG and STG regions?
Yeah. So that, you know, so the main effect of composition localized more posteriorly. And so, you know, in like given the state of the art today, I think we're starting to have kind of a convergence of findings that the more posterior temporal cortex, you know, may be kind of a more structural site. And, you know, from our lab, we've, you know, published, you know, four or five papers kind of, you know, implicating this as well. So this finding is certainly consistent with that. So there, the association level didn't matter, just whether it is actually a phrase or not.
Yeah, I totally agree with you about the more posterior temporal areas being more structural in contrast to the more anterior being more conceptual. And I think there's lots of lines of evidence for that. I think the direction of your finding here was surprising, though, right? So you had more activity in the list condition, regardless of whether they were closely associated or not, and less activity in the compositional condition. Was that an unexpected direction of the effect?
Yeah. So the tricky thing in our hands about the more posterior temporal cortex and its structure sensitivity is that the effects that we've seen just have not been as consistent as the ones that we see more anteriorly. So we definitely see sensitivity there to, you know, like keep the conceptual structure constant, just vary structure. But then exactly the directionalities of the effects, the exact timing, just hasn't been nearly as consistent as for the left ATL. So for that reason, you know, if I give like a full length talk about this topic, I sort of tend to say that the left ATL activity is something that we can kind of hold and examine, but the more posterior effects are just much more slippery in our hands. Mm-hmm. And much harder to kind of get a handle on that. I don't understand the more posterior, you know, like we have not been able to kind of make mechanistic progress on the more structural effects. So,
that's really interesting.
I wave my hands when it comes to that.
But
something's going on there.
Yeah, the nature of the effect makes sense. I guess there's any number of possible.
Yeah. I mean, composition, of course, is a facilitatory factor in language processing. So, you know, when you have a coherent sentence or a coherent structure, we remember it well. It's easier to process than just lists that don't go together. So there's always that way of thinking about, a possible reduction in amplitude as a function of, you know, the presence of syntax. But then, you know, what that exactly reflects is harder.
Yeah. So do you feel like this paper was effective at separating out the different neural processes involved in association and composition?
Well, it definitely, I think, is a step forward. So the research question that we had was answered. So, you know, and so, you know, like if you are trained in my lab, the way I always, you know, sort of explain the endeavor of a scientist is that the beginning of the exercise, all these hypotheses are on the table, and your task is to try to get hypotheses off the table.
Mm-hmm.
And so here, you know, so one of the hypotheses that we had was that, you know, the composition and association would kind of have a similar effect, you know, maybe in a similar brain region. But that was not the case. So that's, I would say, off the table. So instead, you know, the effect of association really depends on whether you actually are combining or not. So, you know, I think that allows you to sort of formulate the next set of questions.
Yeah, I'm sure that's what you're doing. And kind of as a big picture sort of thing, you know, you've done a lot of very controlled experiments like this where you, you know, make these sort of, you know, petri dish kind of situations where you carefully manipulate just one aspect of linguistic structure. You've also done naturalistic experiments where you've looked at narratives and you know, kind of done parsing of the narratives and looked at the brain responses to that. So I was wondering if you can sort of talk about like what you see as the pros and cons of those two different approaches, that both of which you followed, but I think you've more taken the line of these kind of like very fine-grained experiments like the one we're talking about.
Yeah, it really depends on what kinds of students are in the lab at any time. So, you know, at any point, if I had a student who was really wanting to go back to a more naturalistic method, I would happily do that. And I'm doing that. But yeah, I mean, we clearly need both. So the naturalistic methods obviously tell us something about what happens in more ecologically valid circumstances. They're really good for these kind of large scale model comparisons, like, okay, which model wins in explaining brain data? Doesn't mean that that's the right model, but at least we are, you know, we can sort of forget about the other model if one of the models won. So that's all important, an important part of the field. I do feel that the kinds of questions that I really have the most curiosity about are hard to address with a naturalistic method. So, you know, because oftentimes we sort of take advantage of specific types of linguistic phenomena that like give us a, you know, an angle at a kind of a cognitive neuroscience question. Like that is the combination that I find really fun. And that usually then, you know, invites a more controlled experiment. So they, you know, both of them have a role. I think I personally tend to feel like I'm learning more from the controlled experiments, but that's just like, it's kind of more how my brain works. And, you know, I just,
yeah,
I love a good experimental design. Like that's really fun.
And what do you think are the biggest challenges when you're doing the to interpretation, when you're having people do a controlled experiment? Like, you know, just, you know, is the processing of two word phrases sufficiently analogous to, you know, more ecologically valid, you know, syntactic and semantic combinatorics? That's my question.
Yeah. So we, of course, haven't just published these two word phrases, or sometimes people think we do, but, you know, so we have looked at the left ATL kind of conceptual combination effects in several like full sentence studies as well, not naturalistic, but like the usual type of sentence processing. And, you know, there can be some complications, but we definitely have demonstrations that you get this similar types of effects in a full sentential context. Like, for example, if you have a sentence final predicate, and then you have kind of a complex subject that has maybe your varying conceptual specificity in the adjectival position, and then you're also messing around with the polarity of the determiner, like you might have a negative determiner, no angry lizard versus angry lizard, and then, you know, sleeping, All of that is calculated into a conceptual specificity fact at the end of the sentence in a way that you would predict from the minimal composition. But there's many ways in which you can model the picture, which obviously, like, if you have a naturalistic stimulus, it just gets really complicated, and it's really hard to model everything that might go into it. But that's the exercise. Like, I do think it's useful to try to discover what happens in a really minimal tractable situation, and then you can complicate that situation and see what changes. But if you never found out what happens in the situation, then, you know, I do feel like there's something missing.
No, I agree. I think it's important to look at it at all levels. And I mean, and you have looked at it at all levels, right? I mean, you've done minimal combinations and then controlled sentences and then all the way up to narratives. I think that we want to look for these different ways to, like, kind of inform one another and paint the whole picture. I remember when Steve Pinker had decided that, like, he was only going to study the English past tense, and that was going to basically be like the fruit fly of language science. So let's kind of just talk a little bit to wrap up about SNL. So did you enjoy our first in-person conference that we just went to in Philly?
Yeah, I absolutely loved it. I thought it was a really, really great meeting. It was so nice to see everybody. I was really happy with the attendance. Like, I felt like that room was full pretty much in every session. Like, I felt like everyone was going to everything, which is not, you know, normally the case. Like, there's some sessions that aren't as popular as others, but, you know, I was always kind of like looking around. I was like, oh, people are really consistently showing up. So I thought it was really, really great. I really had a great time. How about you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'd missed it so much, you know, just catching up with everybody. It was really nice to be back in person. Were there any, like, particular highlights of the conference for you, like posters or talks that just kind of really captured your attention?
Mm-hmm. I loved, actually, this is a joint student of ours, Deborah Levy or Levy?
Levy.
Yeah, Levy. Her poster was super cool. Uh-huh. Were you a co-author on it?
Yes, but I didn't do much on it.
Okay, that's right. Because we did a lab meeting, which is like SNL souvenirs, and everyone sort of shared their favorite one. So that's the one that I shared. So, you know, I was really excited to see it. So this was from Eddie Chang's group. So she's now a postdoc there.
That's right.
She's a grad student, but she was undergrad at NYU. And so when I met the poster, she actually told me that she had taken my neural basis of language class. And so it was super fun. Yeah. So they had looked at language performance after temporal lobe resection and epilepsy surgery, asking what resections cause Wernicke's aphasia. And it was pretty interesting for me to find out that those resections were very left ATL centered.
Yeah.
Because the neuropsychological profile for the ATL does create somewhat of a tension between, like, our findings with our findings. And so, you know, like, the usual profile that one reads about, like, I'm not a clinical person, but, you know, it's more a kind of a single concept deficit. If you have atrophy there, can you kind of lose the more specific vocabulary? But no one talks about, like, composition or sentence processing. So it was really interesting for me to learn that, you know, immediately after resection, you do have, like a Wernicke's profile that they then recover from. But anyway, that was my.
Yeah.
Oh, that was what I was like really kind of like that.
I'm really glad to hear that you liked that one. I liked it too, of course. Cool. So, you know, you're now the president of SNL, and what kind of things do you think that the society can do? Like, what do you hope to do as president to make the society, you know, better able to support the field and support all of us that work in this field? Do you have plans for the year?
I do kind of feel the challenge. So we are now in this, you know, place in the world where we have to kind of like invent the future of conferencing. You know, we somehow have to have a more climate friendly approach. And now we have learned how you can have tremendous access across the world by doing all sorts of virtual things. So we rapidly learned that. So we see all the pros and cons. Like, you know, most of us are not huge fans of online conferences. I certainly never really got into them. But at the same time, we have to recognize that we have to sort of try to get more global access. And so, you know, I think the, you know, the concept that we're board buddies now, since you're also on the board.
Yeah.
I think we'll discuss this idea of having more virtual events or some kind of virtual activity through the year, while still being able to have an in-person conference, which, you know, I do, and I know how you feel about it, is really, I think, important. So just, you know, I do, it's tough, right? And so hopefully we can make a little bit of progress this year, trying to, you know, settle into some kind of new normal.
Whatever. Yeah. I really like the idea of making it additive, right? So like not taking anything away from the in-person conferences, but just adding something new as well, right? Adding virtual interactions and mm-hmm. virtual opportunities, because that seems like the best of both worlds potentially.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, Marseille in 2023, we're going to be there. Did you go there recently? Were those your own pictures that you posted?
Yeah, I did actually go there last summer. I had some other reasons to go to Marseille as well. I actually have a PhD student there who I hadn't yet met in person. And so I was excited to see her. And then I also checked out the conference venue. I really wanted to see it because it felt weird to me to be organizing this conference there. And I had never been there before. So, you know, I was already in Europe anyway. So I got really excited because it's a really beautiful city. And the venue is really, really beautiful. So I think we'll have a great time.
Yeah, I can't wait. And do you think we should change anything up in the program? Like, people are always asking me, like, when are we going to bring the debates back? I mean, do you think we should, like, bring the debates back? Or have you got any other thoughts about, like, programming?
Debates, that's an interesting question. Yeah, those are fun to watch, but then you have to find the debaters.
Yeah,
so I don't know. I don't know if that concept will fly in the new world.
we could just make it Greg Hickok versus everybody.
Yeah. But
he'd be into that.
You're the chair of the program committee, so you're the one who has to tackle with this question.
Yeah, I know. That's why I'm trying to like ask for other people's ideas.
I like it when there's lots of time to interact.
Yeah. Yeah, the program was very full this year. And I think, I mean, I don't think unreasonably so, because there was a lot to cram in, but yeah, there were not many gaps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We need to leave time for French cheese.
And, that's right. We need time for dinner.
And Korean kimchi.
For the evening. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, it's going to be a lot of fun. Looking forward to working with you and the other board members on it.
Same.
Cool. Well, I'm glad we finally got to do our podcast after like half a year of trying.
Yeah. Yes, me too. Very good.
Yeah. So thank you. And I will catch up with you soon.
Yeah. Thanks, Stephen. Thanks for doing this. You're doing a huge service to the field. So
it's a lot of fun.
I really appreciate it.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. All right.
Take care.
I'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Right. Bye.
Bye.
Okay, well, that's it for episode 24. Thank you very much to Lena for joining me today. I've linked the paper we talked about in the show notes and on the podcast website at langneurosci.org/podcast. I'd like to thank the journal Neurobiology of Language for supporting transcription and Marcia Pettit for transcribing this episode. See you next time.